with Guten Tag, Herr Zimmer. But when my genealogically minded relatives traced our Zimmer ancestors back to my great-great-grandfather, Wolf Zimmer, it turned out he didn't live anywhere near Germany. He lived instead in Galicia, a region in what is now the Ukraine. If we ever manage to reach further back in the Zimmer line, we will probably discover that it vanishes within a few generations. Before the late 1700s, many Eastern European Jews did not use family names. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, of which Galicia was then a part, ordered that all Jews take a name so that they could be more readily taxed. Since Yiddish was banished to private life, the Jews chose names that Austrian officials would approve. It's likely that only then did my ancestors become Zimmer. My name is a convenient fiction. Goodspeed, my mother's name, led me to see England as the other important country of my origins. Reading Shakespeare or Sherlock Holmes tales felt like learning about where I had come from. Genealogy certainly does trace the Goodspeed name back to England, but for me, the Goodspeed name marks only a single branch among many. Pickerel and his colleagues could trace those other branches across many other parts of Europe, perhaps as far away as Spain and Italy, places that my mother's research has never led her to. After I got these results, I paid Pickerel and his colleagues a visit to pester them with questions. If my father was Jewish, how could I be only 43% Ashkenazi? Did that mean that my father was only 86%? Pickerel warned me that their analysis was accurate enough to unsettle my family, but not to give me the final word on my genetic inheritance. You should treat those numbers as an approximation of reality, Pickerel said. Those numbers were the best he could manage at the moment, with the genomes and the methods at hand. That might change if I came back to Pickerel in 10 years. By then, he expected, geneticists would be able to compare millions of human genomes. Instead of relying on variants that are fairly common in at least one population, they may be using rare variants that arose in individuals just a few generations ago and are shared only by their direct descendants. Now it's simply a question of a match. Do you have the genetic variant or not? Pickerel explained to me. Everyone who shares that genetic variant descends from the same common ancestor who lived 200 years ago. That must make life so much easier. Pickerel also warned me that his method could only take me back a few centuries into the past. The groups of people that existed at that time did not necessarily exist a few centuries earlier. Ashkenazi is the name for a particular group of people who lived in a particular place at a particular time. Before AD 1000, the Ashkenazi people did not exist. Their ancestors went by other names. To excavate deeper into my ancestry, I'd need a different genetic shovel. To examine the Ashkenazi-linked DNA in my genome, Dina Zielinski and Nathaniel Pearson of the New York Genome Center used another piece of software, known as RFMix. Developed by scientists at Stanford in 2013, it searches for tiny segments of matching DNA in different people's genomes. Those segments, chopped into little pieces by many generations of meiosis, can reveal ancient kinships. RFMix can match different segments to people from different parts of the world. It's a quilt, Pearson told me, made up of a segment from one ancestor attached to a segment from another ancestor, and we're trying to figure out where those segments came from. Pearson and Zielinski tested my DNA against two possibilities that historians have raised for where Ashkenazi Jews came from. According to one hypothesis, they descend mainly from a kingdom in present-day southern Russia on the northwestern banks of the Caspian Sea. These people, called the Khazars, converted to Judaism perhaps 1,000 years ago. They then migrated north and west into Europe. Many historians have dismissed the Khazar hypothesis, arguing instead that Jews were already living in Italy and France at the time when the Ashkenazi ancestors supposedly converted to Judaism far to the east. These scholars argue instead that the ancestors of Ashkenazi Jews originated in Israel and other parts of the Levant. These people traveled in waves to Italy in the age of the Roman Empire, and from there, they expanded into other parts of southern Europe. Later, when Jews became increasingly persecuted across Europe, some of them came together in Poland to seek refuge. Zielinski and Pearson tested these possibilities by comparing my genome to the genomes of people who would have deep kinship with me. They used genomes from people in France and Italy to look for ancestors in southern and western Europe. They also included a Russian genome to represent eastern Europe. The Khazar kingdom is long gone, and so Zelensky and Pearson used genomes from an ethnic group from the region called the Adigi. To look for an ancestry in the Near East, they added Palestinians and Druze to the analysis. The scientists inspected million base long segments of my DNA and compared them to the same segments in other people's DNA. They used RFmix to find the closest match to each piece in the genomes of the other people in their study. When they were done, they generated a color-coded map of my chromosomes for me. Most of my chromosomes matched the genomes of southwestern Europe or the Near East. A few segments showed a Russian ancestry, and even fewer resembled the Adigi. My genome offers no support for the Khazar theory of the Jews. Zielinski and Pearson carried out only a small-scale study on my DNA, an act of scientific generosity, really. Pearson warned me not to look at their results as the last word on my ancestry. "We have to have tons of grains of salt on the table," he said. Salt notwithstanding, Pearson and Zielinski's results jibed nicely with a much bigger study carried out in 2016 by Shai Carmi of Hebrew University in Jerusalem and his colleagues. They looked at 252,358 single nucleotide polymorphisms in the DNA of 2,540 Ashkenazi Jews, 543 Europeans, and 293 people from the Near East. Carmi and his colleagues couldn't study each genome as deeply as Zielinski and Pearson had, but they could compare many more people hailing from many more regions. Using RFmix and other software, they concluded that Ashkenazi Jews can trace roughly half their ancestry to the Near East, while the other half comes from Europe. The researchers found hints of two separate pulses of mixing. The first occurred in southern Europe. Italy looks like a strong possibility. The second occurred more recently, bringing together Ashkenazim with northern or eastern Europeans. While there are a lot of uncertainties in Carmi's study, it also aligns with historical evidence that the Ashkenazi people emerged through a long migration, with plenty of mingling along the way. My parents are part of an ancient tradition. While some of my father's ancestors may have come from the Near East into Europe 1,000 years ago, my mother's ancestors were probably there long beforehand. Genetic genealogy can't take me back very far into that history, nor can it lead me to the Stone Age villages where my European ancestors lived. But I can be confident that my European roots run deep. In other words, to resort to the language of censuses, I'm white. White makes sense as the name of a cultural group, but as a biological label, it's just as dubious as terms like black and Hispanic. We tend to think of whites as the pale-skinned people of Europe and their descendants, a group of humans joined together on one continent, sharing the same uniform heredity that reaches back for tens of thousands of years. The people who lived in Europe 20,000 years ago might be different in the ways they lived, hunting woolly rhinos instead of posting pictures on Instagram, but we still think of them as white. As scientists have examined the DNA of Europeans, both people who live on the continent today and those who lived there tens of thousands of years ago, they've demonstrated just how wrong-headed those notions are. In the early 1980s, a graduate student at Uppsala University in Sweden named Svante Perbo wondered if he could extract DNA from ancient remains. In 1985, he managed to isolate a few thousand bases from a 2,400-year-old mummy of an Egyptian child. He went on to extract DNA out of far older fossils, pioneering a new field called paleogenetics. Perbo later became the director of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, where he gathered a flock of scientists and graduate students to help him fish for more ancient genes. Other scientists built paleogenetics labs in places like Oxford, Harvard, and Copenhagen. For years, their research was hit or miss. Sometimes fossils turned out to have no DNA at all because they had fossilized in an unforgiving environment. Other fossils had too much DNA. Not from humans, but from bacteria and fungi that invaded the bones after death. And even when the geneticists did find human DNA, it often turned out to belong to a technician or some other living person from whom a flake of skin or a droplet of sweat had wafted into the lab equipment. Perbo and other researchers spent years improving paleogenetics. They figured out how to distinguish new, contaminating DNA from ancient material. They learned not just how to grab one particular piece of DNA from a fossil, but how to grab it all, sequence it, and assemble it into an entire genome. They even got better at picking which bones to drill for DNA. At first, geneticists had simply cut out chunks from whichever bone a museum curator considered expendable. But in the early 2010s, Ron Pinhasi, an archaeologist at University College Dublin, discovered that one kind of bone was far better than the rest. For some reason, the hard, bony case surrounding the inner ear was often rich with DNA, even when none could be found elsewhere in a skeleton. In 2015, paleogeneticists, especially David Reich's team at Harvard University, began publishing dozens, sometimes even hundreds, of ancient European genomes at a time. The results create a kind of genetic transect. Scientists could trace changes in DNA in Europe over more than 40,000 years, mapping them from Spain to Russia. And because this transect was made from whole genomes, each skeleton could tell scientists about thousands of its own ancestors. The oldest fossils of modern humans in Europe, dating back 45,000 years, look much like the bones of living Europeans. But their DNA doesn't give any indication that any living Europeans inherited their genes. Genetically speaking, they look as if they came from a different continent altogether. It's hard to say what became of them. Their particular combination of genetic variants apparently vanished about 37,000 years ago. At a 35,000-year-old site in Belgium, paleoanthropologists managed to get DNA out of another skeleton. The skeleton belongs to a culture known as the Aurignacian, which existed across all of Europe that wasn't buried below the glaciers of the last ice age. They made tools of stone and bone, painted caves with pictures of woolly rhinoceroses, and carved lion-headed figurines. The DNA from the Belgian skeleton had a distinct genetic signature of its own, different from the oldest Europeans. About 27,000 years ago, the Aurignacian culture disappeared from the archaeological record, replaced by a new one called the Gravettian. The Gravettian people used spears to hunt mammoths and nets to trap small game. Reich's team got DNA from Gravettian skeletons and discovered that they too were a distinct people with no direct genetic link to the Aurignacians who came before. For thousands of years, the Gravettian genetic lineage was the only one to be found throughout Europe. And then, remarkably, Aurignacian DNA made a comeback. A Spanish skeleton dating back 19,000 years contains a mixture of Gravettian and Aurignacian DNA. Nobody can say yet where the Aurignacian people disappeared to during the vast intervening time, or how they ended up in Spain, or how people from two such profoundly different cultures ended up having children together. All we know is that for the next few thousand years, everyone in Europe now had genomes blended from these two sources of DNA. About 14,000 years ago, this long stasis was broken. The skeletons from this age now include a third ingredient in their genome. This extra DNA shares some hallmarks with that of people who live today in the Near East. Archaeologists have found that people in the Near East were living as hunter-gatherers at the time. It's possible that as the Ice Age glaciers retreated north, people from the Near East expanded into Europe and began to interbreed with the Gravettian Aurignacian people. And then, once more, Europe settled into a new genetic equilibrium. For another 5,000 years, Europeans inherited their DNA from the same combination of ancestors. The next wave arrived about 9,000 years ago, and these people came with some important baggage. They were not hunter-gatherers, but farmers, bringing crops like wheat and barley with them, along with sheep and goats. These immigrants descended from the first farmers who had domesticated plants and animals some 2,000 years earlier in the Near East. They were not just separated by their culture from the European hunter-gatherers. A wide gulf of ancestry separated them, too. Their common ancestors might have split apart 50,000 years earlier. The farmers expanded from the Near East into Turkey and then westward along the southern edges of Europe. As the farmers cleared land, planted crops, and grazed livestock, some of the hunter-gatherers retreated to less fertile lands, while others interbred, mixing their DNA with that of the newcomers. Over centuries, the isolated populations of hunter-gatherers winked out, while the farmers, now carrying a mix of Near Eastern and European hunter-gatherer genes, settled the entire continent. One more major wave arrived in Europe 4,500 years ago. The DNA of skeletons from that age have many variants in common with a vanished people from the Russian steppes, known as the Yamnaya, They tended vast herds of sheep grazing on the grasslands, following them with horses and wagons. This nomadic way of life was hugely successful for them. They grew so wealthy they could build enormous funeral mounds for their dead, which they filled with jewelry, weapons, and even entire chariots. The DNA of Bronze Age Europeans living 4,500 years ago reveals that the Yamnaya or another closely related people moved into Europe from the Russian steppes. They arrived first in Poland and Germany, building walled cities where they carried on their distinct culture. Within a few centuries, the genetic signature of the steppe people had jumped the English Channel into Britain. At first, the steppe people stayed genetically distinct from the farmers and hunter-gatherers around them. But by the end of the Bronze Age, the barriers around the steppe people and the rest of Europe collapsed, as they had so often before. Skeletons younger than 4,500 years contain melanges of ancestry. Steppe people, Near Eastern farmers, Near Eastern hunter-gatherers, Gravettians, and Aurignacians. After this last major merger, Europe remained a continent of many cultures, but now its people had taken on a genetic profile from which I and other people of European descent draw their ancestry. Ancient DNA demonstrated that white people do not share some deep, pure genetic bond reaching back to the earliest days of the human occupation of Europe. The earliest Homo sapiens to arrive in Europe have no direct connection to living Europeans at all. Living people of European descent can trace their ancestry to the people who came to the continent in a series of waves, separated by thousands of years. These groups were no more closely related to one another than Laplanders are to Indonesians. But in Europe, they encountered each other and mixed their genes. Today's Europeans are fairly uniform, genetically speaking. But that uniformity came out of a biological blender. Ancient DNA doesn't simply debunk the notion of white purity. It debunks the very name white. From the beginning, skin colors were crucial to Western racial categories. The black skin of Africans was merely the outward mark of an inward curse. Along with whites in Europe and blacks in Africa, there were yellow Chinese and red Indians. People whose skin was too light or too dark for their race aroused suspicion about their ancestry. Yet skin color is not a timeless hallmark of human races. It has changed in different places and at different times, probably thanks to natural selection in some cases, and thanks to the movement of people in others. Skin color alleles have traveled the world, working their way into different populations. And the range of light skin tones we call white is only a recent development in this history. People get their particular color from pigment-producing cells in their skin, called melanocytes. Each melanocyte is stuffed with pouches of pigment called melanosomes. One type of pigment is a yellowish-red, and the other is a blackish-brown. The amount and the balance of these pigments together set a person's skin color. Since there are many ways to make these adjustments, add more pigment to each melanosome, for example, or increase the number of melanosomes, mutations to a number of genes can produce similar colors. Today, humans range in color from freckly pale to jet black. The geography of skin color is complicated. Dark skin is hardly unique to Africa. People in Australia, New Guinea, and parts of southern India are just as dark. Nor is Africa itself uniform. While the Dinka of East Africa are among the darkest people on Earth, the San hunter-gatherers of southern Africa are tan. Since hominin skin doesn't fossilize, we can't say for sure what skin color our ancestors had 4 million years ago. But if our closest living primate relatives, gorillas and chimpanzees, are any guide, they likely had light skin. At some point, perhaps 2 million years ago, our ancestors began adapting to life on the African savanna and lost much of their body hair. Once their skin was directly exposed to sunlight, their skin probably started to change color. That's because the ultraviolet rays in sunlight could now more easily strike skin cells. The damage they caused could lead to skin cancer, and could also destroy an essential molecule in the skin called folate. Mutations that added more pigment to the skin could shield our distant ancestors from this harm. In 2017, Sarah Tishkoff, a geneticist at the University of Pennsylvania, led a study to uncover some clues about the early evolution of human skin. She and her colleagues measured the skin reflectance of 1,570 people in Ethiopia, Tanzania, and Botswana. They then scanned the DNA of their volunteers for variants that were common in people with lighter or darker skin. They found 8 variants that were strongly associated with skin color. The researchers searched worldwide DNA databases and discovered that these variants were also present in some populations scattered across the world. By comparing the DNA surrounding these variants, the scientists could estimate how long ago they arose in common ancestors. To their surprise, the researchers found that all 8 variants were hundreds of thousands of years old, older than our entire species, in other words. On its own, this result can't let us know what color the first members of Homo sapiens were. Some of the ancient variants darken skin, but others lighten it. It's possible that they were all present together in early humans, giving them a medium color. Or perhaps there were early humans in Africa who were very dark, and others who were light-skinned. Within Africa, these variants experienced strong natural selection in different places. Close to the equator, wearing few clothes, the Dinka and related people evolved dark skin. In southern Africa, the sunlight was less intense. For the San, dark skin might have actually been a liability. While too much ultraviolet radiation is harmful, too little can cause trouble as well. When the rays strike the skin, they supply the energy our cells need to make vitamin D. Dark skin may have interfered with its production among the San, leading them to evolve their tan skin. Somewhere between 50,000 and 80,000 years ago, a small group of humans expanded out of Africa. Tishkoff and her colleagues discovered that the dark-skinned people of southern India, Australia, and New Guinea all carry the same dark genetic variants she and her colleagues found in Africa. It's possible that one wave of migrants carried the genes for dark skin on a journey across the southern edge of Asia and into the Pacific. Some of the ancient variants for light skin made their way into light-skinned populations in Asia and Europe. Along with these African inheritances, Asians and Europeans also gained new mutations that altered their skin color more. One mutation to a gene called SLC24A5 drastically reduced the pigment that melanocytes make. All living Europeans have it, and so do a substantial fraction of Asian populations. The discovery of ancient DNA in early humans is allowing researchers to get a better sense of how these newer variants arose. In 2014, researchers studied a hunter-gatherer who lived in Spain 7,000 years ago. They found that he carried mutations for blue eyes, but he lacked the mutations to genes such as SLC24A5 that are known to make the skin of living Europeans light. Scientists therefore suspect that this 7,000-year-old hunter from Spain was a dark-skinned, blue-eyed man. Of course, this was just one man. But when scientists looked at the DNA from other skeletons across Europe, they found that it fit a broader pattern. Across Western Europe, in Spain, France, Germany, and Croatia, Europe's hunter-gatherers lacked the skin-lightening mutations found in Europeans today. Farther east, in places like Sweden and the Baltics, scientists have found light skin mutations in skeletons of other hunter-gatherer groups dating back almost 8,000 years. Meanwhile, to the south, the farmers who expanded into Europe from Turkey had only one light variant, perhaps meaning that they had olive skin. Only about 4,000 years ago, as the different populations in Europe started merging, did their skin start to become uniform. This long lag is puzzling. If all that mattered to skin color was ultraviolet rays, then the early humans who came to Europe should have swiftly evolved to become light-skinned and then stayed that way. Nevertheless, the fact remains that more than 40,000 years passed before people in Europe began to perceive themselves as joined by the paleness of their skin. The patterns of inheritance that ancient DNA revealed in Europe, of thousands of years of stability disturbed by sudden mergings of deeply different peoples, have also come to light in other parts of the world. In India today, for example, just about everyone has inherited a mix of DNA from 2 distinct groups of ancestors. One of those groups was most closely related to Europeans, Central Asians, and people from the Near East. The other group, a more enigmatic one, was closely related to the people who live on a tiny archipelago in the Indian Ocean, called the Andaman Islands. The two groups came together to produce the Indian population, as we know it today, within the last 4,000 years. Africa today is home to more than 1.2 billion people, and it is also where most of the fossil record of our species and our more distant hominin ancestors can be found. But that does not mean that living Africans are ancient relics of humanity's past. The genetic profile of many Africans today is profoundly different from that of the people who lived in the same places just a few thousand years ago. While the history of humans in Africa may be far longer than in other parts of the world, Africans are the product of their own turbulent migrations and mixings. Much of the evidence for this turbulence comes from ancient DNA. The fact that scientists managed to get ancient DNA from African skeletons came as a huge surprise to scientists themselves. They assumed that the hot climate of Africa would wipe out the DNA in skeletons. But it turns out that the mountains of countries like Malawi, Kenya, and Ethiopia are cool enough to preserve genetic material. In 2017, David Reich and his colleagues published details on ancient DNA from 16 different Africans who lived as long ago as 8,000 years. Reich's team found that the branches of living sub-Saharan Africans sprouted early in human history. They first began splitting somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 years ago, not long after the origin of our species. Over hundreds of generations, the hunter-gatherers in the south, east, and west of the continent gained distinctive genetic profiles. But despite those differences, they did not become entirely cut off from each other. Some genes managed to flow for thousands of miles through a network of small bands. The ancient DNA Reich and his colleagues studied suggests that at some point the eastern hunter-gatherer population expanded both to the west and east. To the west, Western Africans inherited a substantial amount of their DNA. To the east, these Africans moved out of Africa altogether. Their descendants settled across Europe, Asia, and beyond. But the flow of genes also traveled back into Africa. When Reich and his colleagues studied a 3,000-year-old girl from a tribe of Tanzanian cattle herders, they found that a third of her ancestry belonged not in Africa, but in the Near East, among the first farmers. Younger fossils in Africa revealed that this Near Eastern DNA flowed all the way into South Africa, where it can be found in many living South Africans. These immigrants also appear to have brought the variant in the SLC24A5 gene that makes European skin light, altering the skin of Africans who inherited it. It is possible that these migrants brought something else, crops and livestock. Meanwhile, elsewhere on the continent, other Africans were also domesticating native plants like yams and bananas. About 4,000 years ago, a group of farmers and herders, known as the Bantu, began expanding from the present-day border of Cameroon and Nigeria. Over the next two millennia, they expanded east and south, bringing with them iron tools and a distinctive language. The ancient DNA that Reich and his colleagues extracted from fossils shows that in places like Malawi, the Bantu entirely replaced the earlier hunter-gatherers. In East Africa, they remained distinct for generations before merging with the hunter-gatherers there. Only a handful of tiny tribes in East Africa have a strong genetic link to the people who lived there 3,000 years ago without any Bantu ancestry. And in southern Africa, only a few small groups of hunter-gatherers still carry a genetic legacy that once stretched throughout the region. The people of Madagascar, lying off the east coast of Africa, inherited an even more far-flung combination of genes. Half their genetic ancestry comes from East Africans, and the other half from Southeast Asia. It's likely that a small group of people sailing in the Indian Ocean got swept all the way across. A 2016 study was able to trace the Asian ancestors of Madagascar all the way back to a single village in Borneo. As scientists sequence more DNA from living people and find more in ancient skeletons, they will probably find even more movements and mixings. The further back in time we look, the harder it is to make out the outlines of history. But scientists have already discovered the vestiges of more drastic interbreeding. Ancient encounters that introduced DNA into our gene pool from Neanderthals and other extinct humans. To find out about my own inheritance, I took my genome to the place where the study of human heredity had gotten off to such a dubious start, Cold Spring Harbor. One sunny late winter day, I drove down Bungtown Road along the southern edge of the Long Island Sound and then climbed a high hill to reach the lab. I parked my car and used a map to navigate my way past a bell tower. The tower housed a staircase in the shape of a DNA double helix. The letters of the four bases, A, C, G, and T, were engraved high on its four walls. I shuffled down broad steps to a cluster of research buildings. Inside one of them, I found the office of a young scientist named Adam Siepel. He welcomed me in and had me sit at a table below a giant monitor bolted to a wall. Siepel had a high forehead and kept his hair cropped to near baldness. He kept a miniature rock garden on a shelf by his desk, a rivulet running through the center and making an endless burble. Near his window, Siepel had set a picture of his young son and daughter. Next to the photo was a peculiar skull, with a brow ridge sloped like a trough. It was a cast of a Neanderthal head. Ancestor and descendants, I thought. A century beforehand, the scientists who worked at Cold Spring Harbor would not have taken kindly to the pride of place Siepel gave a Neanderthal. To Charles Davenport and his fellow eugenicists, Neanderthals were nothing more than a brutish victim of humanity's progress, a race below all other races. Davenport would sometimes travel the 40 miles from Cold Spring Harbor to New York City. There he would attend the meetings of the Galton Society at the American Museum of Natural History. Davenport had helped found the society, along with Henry Fairfield Osborne, the president of the museum. It was made up of scientists and wealthy businessmen dedicated to putting eugenics to work in order to save American society. At their meetings, the Galton Society would grouse about Negroes, immigrants from the wrong parts of Europe, and the feeble-minded. Invitations, Davenport once said, were confined to Native Americans. He did not mean Cherokees. Osborne had made his scientific mark as a paleontologist who studied mammal evolution, but by the early 1900s, eugenics became his overriding mission. Heredity and racial predisposition are stronger and more stable than environment and education, he declared. Osborne could not explain genetics to the public as effectively as Davenport or other members of the Galton Society, but he could supply eugenics with its evolutionary backstory. Osborne promoted a eugenic picture of mankind in best-selling books. He even used his museum for the cause, designing its first exhibit about human evolution. Examining the fossil record of the early 1900s, Osborne argued that Central Asia was a nursery for the evolution of new kinds of mammals. Once they evolved there, they expanded outward to other continents in a series of waves. Apes and humans were no different, Osborne believed. Their new forms also emerged from the Asian nursery. Each new wave was more sophisticated than the previous one, often eradicating them when they met. One of the earliest waves to emerge from Asia, Osborne claimed, was the Neanderthals. In 1856, quarry workers in Germany had found the first fragments of Neanderthal fossils. They suggested heavy-set humans with thick brow ridges. By the early 1900s, more Neanderthal fossils had emerged across Europe. Looking at their bones, Osborne pictured a lumbering brute, an enormous head placed upon a short and thick trunk, with limbs very short and thick-set, and very robust, the shoulders broad and stooping. Even the hands of Neanderthals seemed huge and clumsy to Osborne, who said they were without the delicate play between the thumb and fingers characteristic of modern races. On tours of Europe, Osborne would visit caves to acquaint himself with Neanderthal remains. He could see that Neanderthals had been capable of hunting big game like horse and bison, but their stone tools were primitive compared to more recent ones, and no one could find any trace of Neanderthal art. This evidence, or the lack of it, only strengthened Osborne's conviction that Neanderthals had subhuman minds. Not so agreeable were their giant brain cases. If Neanderthals were extinct subhuman brutes, they shouldn't have had brains as big as living humans. Osborne dodged this quandary by ignoring the size of their brains and making much of their shape instead. The Neanderthal brain lacked the superior organization of the brain in recent man, Osborne declared, especially in the prefrontal cortex, which is the seat of the higher faculties. When Osborne established the Hall of the Age of Man in his museum, he had murals and busts of Neanderthals put on display. He ordered them to be depicted as dark-skinned, hairy, and brutish. The Neanderthals represent a side branch of the human race, which became wholly extinct in Western Europe, he said. The Neanderthals didn't just quietly disappear, however. They were annihilated by the Cro-Magnons, Osborne believed, a race which had evolved in Asia and which was in no way connected by any ancestral links with the Neanderthals. Osborne believed that Cro-Magnons were far superior, a race with a brain capable of ideas, of reasoning, of imagination, and more highly endowed with artistic sense and ability than any uncivilized race which has ever been discovered. Their superiority, in fact, allowed the Cro-Magnons to wrest control of Europe. They were armed with weapons which, with their superior intelligence and physique, would have given them a very great advantage in contests with the Neanderthals, Osborne said. Judging from this superiority, Osborne believed Cro-Magnons probably belonged to the Caucasian stock. Along with Caucasians, Osborne recognized Mongoloids and Negroids as three absolutely distinct stocks, which in zoology would be given the rank of species, if not of genera. Osborne was never very clear about the order in which the three stocks arose, but he was sure that Negroids emerged first. For proof, he pointed to how they fared on Henry Goddard's intelligence tests. The standard of intelligence of the average adult Negro is similar to that of the 11-year-old youth of the species Homo sapiens, he said. Making matters worse, the Negroids had expanded into the tropics, where food was easy to get and intelligence was thus not favored by evolution. Here we have the environmental conditions which have kept many branches of the Negroid race in a state of arrested development, Osborne said. To Osborne, the history of white people did not end with the Cro-Magnons. The Nordic race of Caucasians arose 12,000 years ago and swept into Europe. They had the strongest race plasm, as Osborne liked to call it, and thus they had produced the greatest men in history, from Columbus to Leonardo da Vinci to Cervantes. Never mind that these luminaries were not Nordics, but were born rather in Italy and Spain. To maintain the vigor of the Nordic race, Osborne believed, eugenicists would have to make sure they didn't taint their race plasm by marrying people of the lower races. In 1935, Osborne died of a heart attack while sitting in his study in his upstate New York mansion. He collapsed as he was engaged in writing a 1,250,000-word treatise on the evolution of the elephant, according to the New York Times. Osborne's death occasioned many obituaries and public memorials, which mostly dwelled on his paleontological achievements and his leadership at the museum. They carefully avoided any mention of the fondness he had developed for Nazi Germany, or the visit he paid there a year before his death to accept an honorary degree. By the time Osborne died, eugenics was losing much of its luster. Osborne's cherished theory of Asian human origins would eventually be proven wrong. By the 1960s, it was becoming abundantly clear that humans originated in Africa, Osborne's dismal tropical dead end. The oldest human-like fossil yet found, Sahelanthropus chadensis, lived about 7 million years ago in what is now Chad. For the next 5 million years, our ancient relatives, known as hominins, lived as small-brained bipedal apes in eastern and southern Africa. Starting about 2 million years ago, waves of hominins began expanding out of Africa to populate Europe and Asia, but the center of hominin evolution remained in Africa. By 600,000 years ago, the hominins on our own branch of the family tree had evolved to our own height and brain size. They were making sophisticated tools beyond the skill of earlier hominins. They were not just hominins anymore. They could rightly be called humans. Some early humans stayed in Africa and evolved into our species, Homo sapiens. Others expanded their range beyond Africa, gradually adapting to life on other continents. That wandering population became the Neanderthals. Research on Neanderthals since Osborne's death has dramatically improved their reputation. Paleoanthropologists have found the remains of Neanderthals well outside of Europe, as far away as the Near East and Siberia. For more than 300,000 years, they had a range the size of Australia, encompassing mountains, grasslands, and forests. Neanderthals were versatile at finding food. In addition to catching big game, Neanderthals who lived on the coast would fish, kill dolphins, and harvest mussels. Neanderthals knew how to cook the pitch of birch trees into a glue for fixing stone blades to wooden spear handles. They marked their bodies red with ochre and wore jewelry made from the claws of eagles. They arranged stalagmites into enormous circles deep inside caves, perhaps as sites for subterranean worship. Despite all their newly appreciated adaptations, Neanderthals still disappeared. The youngest Neanderthal sites are 40,000 years old. Our own species may well have played a part in their demise when some Africans expanded into Europe and Asia. Sometimes this expansion took modern humans into Neanderthal territory, where the two kinds of people overlapped for thousands of years. In 1995, a technician at the Rheinisches Landesmuseum in Bonn, Germany, did something unheard of. He switched on a sterile electric saw and pushed it into the fossil of a Neanderthal's arm. This was not just any Neanderthal fossil. It belonged to the first cache of the extinct humans ever discovered, unearthed in 1856 by quarry workers clearing a cave. Now, 139 years later, the technician carved out a C-shaped chunk from the arm fossil. Under the whirring saw blade, it gave off a whiff of burnt bone. The museum had decided it was time to have a paleogenetics expert look for DNA in some of their fossils, and they chose Svante Perbo. When they shipped him the Neanderthal bone, Perbo assigned one of his graduate students, Matthias Krings, to work on it. Krings managed to extract short stretches of mitochondrial DNA from the fossil. One day, he fed the genetic material into a sequencing machine to read it. Krings could only hope that he had not contaminated the sample with the DNA of a living animal, including himself. The fragment of DNA Krings extracted measured only 379 bases long. He compared it to the same stretch in the mitochondrial DNA of more than 2,000 living humans. Most of the fossil DNA matched the human stretches perfectly. But here and there, it had mutations not found in any living person. It differed from every human sequence Krings studied on average by 28 bases. Late in the night, Krings picked up a laboratory phone to give Perbo an urgent update. "It's not human," he said. It was the first time anyone had found DNA from an extinct human-like fossil. The discovery led Perbo to undertake a scientific expedition unlike anything that had come before. He and his colleagues persuaded other museums to let them drill other Neanderthal fossils. They enlisted paleoanthropologists to send them fresh material from their digs. Perbo's group built up a genetic portrait of Neanderthals across their entire range, gathering not just mitochondrial DNA, but DNA from their chromosomes as well. Their research revealed that Neanderthals varied from one another, but they had much less variation than living humans do. It became clear that they represented a separate branch of humans that lived in small groups with little genetic diversity. As new kinds of DNA sequencing technology became available, Perbo and his colleagues would snatch them and adapt them to their research. They extracted more DNA from each fossil they studied, and their reconstructions grew more accurate. In 2010, they managed to build a rough draft of about 60% of the entire Neanderthal genome. To understand how it fit into human evolution, Perbo enlisted David Reich and his colleagues. Base by base, they compared the Neanderthal DNA to that of a chimpanzee and of humans from different parts of the world. The scientists found that Neanderthals shared many genetic variants in common with modern humans, variants that aren't shared by chimpanzees. These shared variants must have arisen after our hominin ancestors split away from the ancestors of other living apes, but before the split between modern humans and Neanderthals. Perbo and his colleagues also cataloged a number of variants that arose only in Neanderthals, and others only in the modern human lineage. But they were still left with some variants that didn't quite fit in any of these categories. These variants were sprinkled in the DNA of some Europeans and Asians they studied, but they couldn't find any in living Africans. The strongest explanation for the pattern was one that would have appalled Henry Fairfield Osborne. Neanderthals must have interbred with the modern humans who expanded out of Africa and would go on to settle across the Old World. That included the Europeans whom Osborne believed to be his beloved pure Nordic race. Perbo and his colleagues estimated that living non-Africans could trace 1-4% of their genetic ancestry to Neanderthals. There is thus more Neanderthal DNA on Earth today than when Neanderthals existed.
By 2010, when Perbo and his colleagues published the first evidence for Neanderthal interbreeding, genetic genealogy was a thriving industry. It was ready to seize such a sensational finding and make the most of it. 23andMe quickly put together a test that they claimed could tell customers just how much of their genome was Neanderthal. When I told people about my reporting about Neanderthals, some of them would eagerly let me know about their percentage. The more Neanderthal DNA they carried, the happier they sounded. Judging from comments that customers have left on 23andMe's website, Neanderthal pride is a common thing. I am very proud of my 2.8% Neanderthal DNA, someone named Gail wrote in 2011. Neanderthals had larger brains than modern humans, cared for the sick and elderly, buried their dead, wore jewelry in the form of painted seashells, crafted musical instruments, and gave us hybrid vigor. Replying to Gail, another commenter named Leanne wondered if Neanderthal DNA might explain the look of her family. I haven't been tested, although I should, out of curiosity, she wrote. My genealogy has me as the 27th great-granddaughter of William the Conqueror, the Saxon that made England Anglo-Saxon. Every generation in the modern family of the past 200 years has one or two tall, heavy-boned people, surrounded by average height and weight. My brother was 5'10", 165 pounds. I am 6 feet tall, big-boned, along with carrying some extra weight. I am hairier than he is. He cannot grow a beard. I could grow a beard on my legs alone. Ancient DNA experts had mixed feelings about this new Neanderthal mania. They were happy to see all the enthusiasm over their research, but they also didn't like the pretzels into which it was getting stretched. The 23andMe test, for example, was based only on the 2010 rough draft of the Neanderthal genome. Only later did Perbo and his colleagues discover that a Neanderthal toe bone from Siberia was packed with DNA. So much DNA that they were able to reconstruct the entire genome with high accuracy. In 2014, the researchers compared this high-quality Neanderthal genome to more than 1,000 human genomes. It was like switching a microscope to a far more powerful lens. Africans turned out to have between 0.08 and 0.34% Neanderthal DNA, likely from the migration of people from the Near East to the continent. Non-Africans had ancestry varying from just over 1% to 1.4%. That was a far narrower window than the 1 to 4% in the original estimates. And within each population, the variation from person to person was far smaller. Central Europeans had an average of 1.17% Neanderthal DNA, plus or minus only 0.08%. When the Neanderthal researchers published their analysis, they went out of their way to take a swipe at the 23andMe test. For the most part, the researchers said, the test only delivered statistical noise. Even if some people actually did have twice as much Neanderthal DNA than others, that wouldn't somehow make them more Neanderthal, as if Neanderthalness were a spice sprinkled into our genomic soup. Living people who carry Neanderthal DNA have thousands of genetic fragments scattered by meiosis throughout their chromosomes. Most of those fragments probably do nothing at all. Our protein-coding genes make up only about 1% of the human genome. It's possible that a few percent more is made up of genes that encode important RNA molecules. Some additional DNA may be important to us as millions of tiny genetic switches, where proteins known as transcription factors can attach to turn genes on and off. But it's likely that the vast majority of human DNA has no function. It's just along for the ride. Inheriting a Neanderthal piece of this so-called junk DNA instead of the human version should make no difference to us. Some of the Neanderthal DNA we inherit can potentially make a difference if it contains important genes or stretches of DNA that help turn genes on and off. But from one person to the next, the fragments of Neanderthal DNA that survive in the genome are different. Whatever the impact of our Neanderthal inheritance may turn out to be, it will depend on the particular genes each of us inherit. To find out what my Neanderthal DNA meant to me, I enlisted Adam Siepel, who by then had been studying ancient genomes for several years at Cold Spring Harbor. He was intrigued by the request, admitting that he had never been a big fan of the 23andMe Neanderthal test. They just give you a number, he said. They don't tell you where you're Neanderthal. I arranged for Siepel to get my genome, and then he and two of his colleagues, Melissa Jane Ubisch and Elon Gronau, set about analyzing it. They used a statistical method they had invented a few years beforehand that can detect mixtures of different kinds of inherited DNA that might go overlooked by other methods. First, the scientists chopped up my genome into thousands of sections, each a million bases long. They then compared each of those sections to corresponding ones in people of European, Asian, and African descent. They also compared my sections of DNA to those of Neanderthals and chimpanzees, the closest living species related to humans. Siepel and his colleagues tested out many evolutionary trees to see which accounted best for all these similarities and differences. They drew trees with different sets of branches, and also investigated scenarios in which DNA slipped from one branch to another, thanks to interbreeding. It builds a coherent model that has to explain everything, Siepel said. It took days for a computer to churn through all the data, explore all the possibilities, and finally produce an answer. To walk me through the results, Hubisch joined Siepel and me in his office while Gronau, calling in from Israel, peered down at us from a video screen. You're definitely pushing us into a new area, Siepel said. It's actually a little addictive once you start. Together, they unveiled my genealogical tree, reaching back over 500,000 years. My genome shared a close ancestry with those of other living Europeans. Beyond Europe, they found that Asians were my closest relatives, as a result of the expansion of humans out of Africa. They compared my genome to a Southern African hunter-gatherer's and estimated we could trace our ancestry back to a common ancestral population that existed over 100,000 years ago. On my genealogical tree, I could see Neanderthals on a far more distant branch, splitting off hundreds of thousands of years earlier. But some of the DNA that Siepel and his colleagues analyzed didn't travel obediently down these branches. Some had jumped from Neanderthals into humans. Each of the humans outside of Africa that Siepel, Gronau, and Hubisch studied had ended up with a different vestige of Neanderthal DNA. To show me mine, Hubisch opened up a browser on the monitor. Long black bars marked places where one copy of a chromosome carried DNA from Neanderthals. In some regions, I had inherited Neanderthal DNA from both my mother and father. The largest of those doubly inherited regions spans 189,871 bases. When Hubisch tallied the number of stretches that were 10,000 bases or longer, she ended up with over 1,000. Some of those spans didn't contain a gene or any other stretch of DNA with a known function, but some of them had promise. I have a list of interesting regions, Siepel said, pulling out a piece of paper. There's a lot I don't know about these, but here are some that I've flagged. One segment contained a gene called DSCF5, for example, that has been linked to coronary artery disease. We can click on a few others that I found, Siepel said. He threw out names of other genes, CEP350, GPATCH1, and PLOD2. Catchy name, he muttered. Siepel might be able to name my Neanderthal genes, but he couldn't say which Neanderthal I inherited them from. He couldn't say if it was a male or female Neanderthal, or when that Neanderthal lived, or where. He and other researchers were still just trying to make out the broad outlines of Neanderthal interbreeding. As best they could tell, Neanderthals and humans interbred many times, over a period that may have stretched over 200,000 years. The earliest hints of interbreeding came to light in 2017. Researchers studying the DNA of European Neanderthals determined that their mitochondria came from an ancient human woman who lived more than 270,000 years ago. It's possible that early members of Homo sapiens made their way from northern Africa to southern Europe, where they interbred with the Neanderthals there. If this encounter did happen, those early humans must have vanished, leaving behind only their mitochondria in later generations of Neanderthals. Siepel and his colleagues have found more evidence of human DNA in Neanderthals more than 100,000 years ago. The fossil record offers hints of where this encounter took place, in the Near East. On the coast of Israel, there is a place called Mount Carmel. Inside its caves, scientists have found the fossils of both Neanderthals and modern humans. The Neanderthals lived in the region from at least 200,000 years ago. Modern humans make a brief appearance at Mount Carmel about 100,000 years ago, and then the Neanderthals return for another 50,000 years before giving way for good to modern humans. It's possible that the 100,000-year-old humans of Mount Carmel belonged to a brief expansion out of Africa. Before they vanished, they may have contributed their own DNA to Neanderthals. The DNA of living humans documents more recent encounters, after humans expanded successfully out of Africa sometime between 50,000 and 80,000 years ago. In a 2016 study, Joshua Akey and his colleagues at the University of Washington found different patterns of Neanderthal DNA in different groups of people, suggesting that the interbreeding happened in at least three separate episodes. The first took place not long after modern humans came back to the Near East. This was before non-Africans split into today's major lineages, and so the DNA from this first mingling can be found in all non-African populations. The ancestors of people who live in Australia and New Guinea then split from the rest of non-Africans and moved east along the coast of Asia. The second interbreeding with Neanderthals happened after that split, And today, the DNA from that contact can be found in Europeans and East Asians, but not in New Guinea or Australia. Finally, after Europeans split from the ancestors of East Asians, Neanderthals bred a third time with the ancestors of East Asians. Of course, a study like Aikie's has its limits. It can't tell us about other interbreeding that didn't leave any DNA behind in living humans, nor can it offer all the cinematic details about how the mating took place. Were Neanderthal males having sex with modern human females, or was it the reverse? Did people willingly cross into new societies to raise their children, or were they slaves? For now, we can only craft the different stories we might tell, depending on what the answers to those questions would be. But the laws of heredity can let us know some things about our Neanderthal inheritance. The children of Neanderthals and humans got half of their DNA from each kind of human. At least some of them must have been welcomed into modern human groups. They must have been cared for and nurtured. They must have gotten the opportunity to have children of their own. Our own DNA is proof. If those hybrids mated with modern humans, their children would have inherited a quarter of their DNA from a Neanderthal grandparent. Their Neanderthal DNA would be chopped up and shuffled with the DNA of their other grandparents. Over future generations, meiosis split up the Neanderthal DNA into still smaller segments. Some ancient human fossils turn out to have as much as 6 to 9% Neanderthal DNA. Over time, the average amount dwindled. One plausible explanation for that decline is that most Neanderthal DNA is bad for our health. Inheriting a Neanderthal version of a gene may cause people to have fewer children, either because they're less likely to survive to childbearing age or because they become less fertile. It may be no coincidence that Neanderthal genes that play a role in reproduction are especially rare in humans today. As future generations of humans inherit Neanderthal DNA, some of it may continue to disappear. But some Neanderthal DNA seems to have endured for tens of thousands of years because it gave our ancestors some benefit. I've discovered that my genome, for example, includes some Neanderthal versions of genes that help fight infections. I'm hardly alone. Neanderthal immune genes are more common in living humans than many other classes of genes. Once they slipped into the modern human gene pool, these genes appear to have become more widespread with time. Our immune system genes are some of the fastest evolving parts of our genome because they need to keep up with the rapid evolution of the parasites that are trying to evade our defenses. People who live in malaria-prone regions have evolved new defenses against the parasites in just the past few thousand years. When early Africans moved onto other continents, they may have encountered a number of diseases for the first time. Neanderthals, on the other hand, had been adapting to those medical challenges for hundreds of thousands of years. Borrowing immune system genes from Neanderthals could have been a quick way to get better odds of surviving in their new home. One of the most startling revelations about my own heredity came up toward the end of my visit to Cold Spring Harbor. After running through all his results, Gronau said something so casually that I almost missed it. "There's some Denisovan gene flow in Carl's genome," he said. I sat up straight. "What?" "You have a tiny bit, which is more than I see in the other genomes that I've tried," Gronau said. In 2009, a Russian researcher sent Svante Perbo a nondescript chip of bone from a pinky. It had come to light during a dig in a Siberian cave called Denisova. There was no reason to expect anything interesting from the chip, but Perbo's student, Johannes Krause, discovered that it was actually packed with DNA. While much of that DNA belonged to bacteria that had invaded the bone long after death, there was also a lot that looked human-like. Krause assumed it would either be Neanderthal or modern human DNA, but when he inspected it closely, it turned out to be neither. It belonged to another extinct human. In honor of the cave where it was found, Perbo and his colleagues named these phantom people the Denisovans. In the next few years, Perbo and his colleagues tested out other fossils for Denisovan DNA and managed to find some more from molars dug up in the same Siberian cave. The scientists cannot look at Denisovan skeletons to compare their anatomy to ours. They're left in the strange situation of knowing a group of extinct human relatives almost entirely from their DNA. That DNA reveals that Denisovans were most closely related to Neanderthals, not modern humans. They split from a common ancestor as long as 470,000 years ago. In 2017, Perbo and his colleagues examined the mutations in four Denisovan individuals and estimated that the oldest individual who lived in the Denisova cave was there over 100,000 years ago. The youngest known Denisovan lived there about 50,000 years ago. Like Neanderthals, Denisovans have left their genetic mark on living humans. The people who carry the highest amounts of Denisovan DNA, in some cases more than 5%, live in Australia, New Guinea, and nearby Pacific Islands. Scientists have also found tiny amounts of Denisovan DNA in the genomes of East Asians and Native Americans. Paradoxically,